This is an insightview.eu podcast. In this podcast, InsightView has asked Camilla Noerup Sorensen, who is an associate professor at the Institute for Strategy at the Royal Danish Defence College in Copenhagen, about the impact of the pandemic on global politics and the world order. We talk about who are the winners and losers. We touch on implications for China, Russia, the United States and Europe. Also, InsightView asks Camilla whether a second term for President Trump might turn out to be the last straw ending an already fragile relationship between Europe and the United States.
At the beginning of the corona crisis, China seemed to be the big loser. Beijing was forced to impose a lockdown because political decision makers did not respond to information from Chinese healthcare workers before it was too late, although this was faster than during SARS. An even bigger policy mistake was made by health authorities in Europe and the United States, who underestimated the risk that the virus outbreak would spread to their population. Not surprisingly, a fight has broken out between not least Washington and Beijing about who has the real narrative of the coronavirus crisis. Which narrative is the right one?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to stress that the relationship between the US and China already before the corona crisis was seriously worsening. One of the most respected and knowledgeable analysts on US-China relations, Bill Bishop, he characterized the relationship as being in the worst state since the establishment of diplomatic relations between the US and China in 78. So this was even before the coronavirus, right? We had the US-China trade war, the growing US concerns, and increasingly active US efforts to prevent Chinese companies, especially high-tech companies, from expanding outside China, for example, the Chinese telecommunication company Huawei. So this is just to point out that the coronavirus did not cause the current crisis in US-China relations, but it has definitely accelerated the pace of the tension and deepening the crisis further. And part of it is the struggle over the narrative, as you say, who is right, who caused the corona crisis, who's to blame, who is doing the best job. And I think the only thing that's safe to say is that neither the US or the Chinese narrative is the right one. They might be more or less right, but both the Chinese leadership and the American leadership has made big mistakes in handling the coronavirus and shown incompetence and displayed, you could say, the weaknesses in their respective political system. And another important point here, also explaining why both the US President Trump and the Chinese President Xi Jinping has found it necessary to aggressively push for their specific narrative, is that both leaders are primarily speaking to a domestic audience. That is, both Trump, especially with the upcoming presidential election, and Xi is under a lot of pressure domestically, and they are focused on dealing with this and rallying the domestic audience or their own population behind them. And I think specifically with the Chinese narrative, this about presenting China as the first country to defeat the coronavirus and now helping other countries as a constructive and responsible great power, we tend to assume here that this narrative is directed at us, at the international society, to gain Chinese soft power, etc. But it is this is likely part of the motivation in Beijing. But I think the most important audience, or where this narrative is primarily directed, is inside China. It is the Chinese population, more specifically maybe the top of the Communist Party, because these are the groups that Xi Jinping primarily needs to convince to show that he is, you know, he has dealt with the crisis, he has it under control, he's a strong leader. And again, this because he is under a growing pressure and his primary focus is to stay in control in China. That's the most pressing challenge, you could say. So I think we need to acknowledge that there are these domestic focuses with President Trump and with Xi Jinping.
Which narrative will prevail in the coming years in the US and Europe, respectively?
Well, the narrative we have now, the Trump-led and the Xi Jinping-led, they will most likely change over the years, and we don't know what will happen. I'm sure we'll get to that, but we don't know what will happen if President Trump is not reelected. But what I what I think is safe again to say is that the anti-China sentiment in the US is not going away, even with a Democratic president. So I don't think there is a much chance of a Chinese narrative winning much support in the US. But we might see a less confrontational US narrative. And if that is the case, if we have a Democratic president after November and a less confrontational U.S. narrative, that might receive more support in Europe, because I think the current Trump-Pompeo-led very confrontational narrative is not winning much support in Europe. European leaders such as the German Chancellor Merkel has tried to find a middle ground and put focus on dealing with the current crisis rather than taking part of in this blame game. But of course, also in Europe, there are growing calls for an investigation of how, or rather where, the coronavirus started and how the Chinese authorities have dealt with it, what they did when did they tell the WHO, etc. So there is this call for, you could say, accountability and more transparency. So I think Europe is still not settled, and Europe is not a single entity. We see different European countries trying to maneuver in different ways in this current US-China growing tension or rivalry. And it is generally a big challenge for the EU to find its own common position or its own way to maneuver in this general US-China great power competition. So I think it's still too early to say who will actually come out best, US or China, or you could say who will come out less bad. I think it's too early to say, but I think a lot will depend on when the US and China get the economy restarted, and also maybe who succeeds in producing the best treatment and the best vaccines first, and whether they choose to share it with the rest of the world, because that, I think, will of course not change the basic economic and military balance of power between them, but it might matter in this about the narrative and the perception or the soft power balance, you could say.
Which narrative prevails among the Chinese people?
Well, in the first month or in the first months of the year, when the crisis was really intense in Wuhan and China in general, with the lockdowns, and the almost total standstill in the Chinese economy, there was a strong criticism of the Chinese response and the lack of information and openness on the Chinese social media. There was a display of mistrust, of doubt, and of questioning, and a lot of frustration, actually. But as Beijing, or as Xi Jinping himself, went in and took more control of the situation, and as the virus came more under control in China, and as it further spread outside of China, the mood somehow changed on the Chinese social media to have more focus on, you know, on being supportive and being more proud of how China managed to deal with the virus crisis or the corona crisis. And especially in recent weeks and months, as China has come under stronger criticism from the US, many in China find this really unfair and see Trump using China as a scapegoat for his own incompetent handling of the coronavirus. So this has somehow changed the focus. And of course, the Chinese propaganda has also went into full swing of presenting the Communist Party, and specifically President Xi, as leading and winning the struggle against the coronavirus. So gradually, this narrative, if you will, has gained more ground in China, and it's got mixed up with a stronger or growing popular nationalism that's also displayed on Chinese social media. But I still think that we shouldn't underestimate the continuous mistrust and doubt in the Chinese society, or the frustration and the tension this we also saw was growing before the coronavirus and related especially to the struggling Chinese economy and the growing economic inequality in China. So there is still a lot of tension and a lot of frustration in the Chinese society. So the main challenge for Xi Jinping and for the Communist Party today is the restructuring and the upgrading of the Chinese economy, because that is simply necessary in order to deal with the big challenges that China is facing, and to deal with the causes of the growing tension and frustration in the Chinese society. And you could say this about restructuring and upgrading the Chinese economy. Well, it might have, the coronavirus crisis might have made it more acute, but it's not less of a challenge, because now you have a lot of extra challenge on top of that, right?
In the same context, how do the Chinese people rate President Xi Jinping today compared to the time before the coronavirus outbreak? Is President Xi Jinping stronger than before the crisis?
Well, that's a difficult one. We really don't know. I would argue, and again, I argued this also before the coronavirus, that we shouldn't overestimate the individual strength of Xi Jinping. He might be the strongest leader that China has had since Deng Xiaoping, but he still needs to negotiate. He still needs to make compromises. He still needs to ensure support, not only in the top of the Communist Party, that's of course most important, but he also needs support from influential groups in the Chinese bureaucracy, in the private sector, in the military, and in society. So he continuously needs to ensure that he has legitimacy and support. So whether he comes out stronger after the coronavirus, I think is a lot of the other things, maybe still too early to say, right? Because the corona crisis is maybe also still ongoing in China. It is still ongoing in China. We have this about a second wave now, and Wuhan is again starting to test. So I think it's too early to say, but I think the most important factor now and in the end will be whether Xi Jinping and the top of the Communist Party is able to get the Chinese economy back on track, because that is simply necessary to deliver on this, as I mentioned before, about the restructuring and the upgrading of the Chinese economy, so they can deal with the challenges and the tensions in the Chinese society. For example, can they deliver on the promise of lifting another 10 million Chinese people, primarily in the rural sector, out of poverty before the end of 2020, right? That was a promise they made several years ago. And he repeated it, Xi Jinping, very recently, but it looks very difficult to deliver on that. It's a tremendous challenge. But that is what matters the most. So get the economy restarted, go through with some of the reforms or the restructuring of the economic model. But of course, if we then have a growing tension with the US, that could actually end in an actual military confrontation, for example, in the Taiwan Strait or in the South China Sea. That could direct focus also in the Chinese population. So because there actually is a strong support in the Chinese population to Xi Jinping that takes this more uncompromising line in relation to these Chinese core interests as the Taiwan Strait and the South China Sea. And I think what we're seeing in recent weeks is that there is kind of this rally around the flag development, because the general sentiment in China seems to be that China is facing a more hostile world, a more hostile US. There was an internal report last week, a leak from an internal report from one of the research institutes under the Chinese military under the Chinese Ministry of State Security, that stated that the anti-China sentiment in the world has not been as high as we see now since the Tiananmen in 89. So there is a sense in China that now they are really facing huge challenges also in outside. Also in relation to the US specifically, but generally outside in their effort that's been ongoing for several years in trying to build China up as a respected, influential great power. So now here they're also facing tremendous challenges.
In the context of the coronavirus outbreak, Taiwan and South Korea has been among the countries best prepared for the pandemic. WHO has only reluctantly acknowledged Taiwan's successful performance. It seems that Taiwan and the United States have moved closer together during the coronavirus crisis. Is Taiwan's situation stronger in the ongoing confrontation with Beijing after the coronavirus crisis, or is the opposite the case because Taiwan's success has been a thorn in the eye of Beijing?
Well, again here, the growing Chinese pressure on Taiwan was clear also before the corona crisis. So the crisis has maybe accelerated and highlighted it, but it is not the cause. I was in Taiwan in early January this year at the time of the presidential election and the parliamentary election on the island. And the people I spoke with from the Taiwanese government, the Taiwanese military, the research communities and society or NGO groups, they were all concerned about what they saw as a more aggressive Chinese campaign to undermine the Taiwanese democracy, to cause division in the Taiwanese society and demonstrate the Chinese military's upper hand, you could say, in the Taiwan Strait. And all this to discourage any attempts from Taiwan to move towards any kind of greater Taiwanese autonomy, not to speak of Taiwanese independence. So this was already ongoing. It's been ongoing, this Chinese campaign, since at least since the more pro-independent political party, the DPP, came to power in Taiwan in 2016, and they were just re-elected. The Taiwanese president Tsai Ing-wen from DPP was just re-elected in January this year. So this is because Beijing sees a more pro-independent movement in Taiwan. So they stepped up the campaign, you could say, the pressure on Taiwan. And as you also indicate in your question, this campaign has been further intensified since the U.S. under President Trump has sought to strengthen economic, diplomatic, and military relations and support to Taiwan and to President Tsai Ing-wen. So it's definitely both because of a development in Taiwan with the more pro-independence party and because of the strengthening of relations between Taiwan and the U.S. But this was already ongoing before the corona crisis. And then, of course, the whole situation in Hong Kong with the growing pressure on the one country, two systems model, which seen from Beijing is also covering Taiwan. This has also made Beijing more concerned and determined to show Taiwan and to show the US that Taiwan independence is a no-go. This is out of the question, right? So the Taiwanese situation or the situation in the Taiwan Strait definitely looks very worrying, I think, especially as U.S.-China relations further worsening, and Taiwan is in the middle of this, right? It will be increasingly difficult for Taiwan to find a way to balance. It needs support from the U.S. Otherwise, it stands no chance to stand up to China, but too much U.S. support also risk provoking Beijing, right? So it's a very delicate balance for Taiwan. And then on top of that, what also plays into the whole situation in the Taiwan Strait, as we also talked about before, is that Beijing is also under some pressure domestically from a more nationalistic sentiment in China that wants to see, you know, resolve or more, maybe not impatient, but at least now sees there is a growing pressure for doing something in relation to Taiwan, as they also see the U.S. strengthening relations to Taiwan. So it's a very worrying situation in general in the Taiwan Strait.
Then we move a little bit further north. At the beginning of the corona crisis, Russia seemed to have escaped the global pandemic, at least according to Russia's statistics. Lately, this has proved not to be the case. Today, Russia is one of the hardest hit, and there are no signs that the outbreak has peaked. President Putin's popularity has plunged. Moreover, the price of Russia's main source of income, oil, has collapsed. Has Russia's global position weakened during the corona crisis? Is Putin's political life at risk?
Again, it's difficult to say, and maybe also still a bit too early to judge. The crisis is, as you also point to, still very much ongoing in Russia with a lot of infected people. Also in the top leadership, with Putin's spokesperson and the prime minister apparently both tested positive in recent days. So Russia is now the country with the world's second highest number of coronavirus infections. And Russia has had this non-working period of state for several weeks. Apparently they don't like the quarantine concept, so they use this non-working term. But the problem in Russia with this is, of course, both the health crisis, but also the economic crisis, as in other countries, right? That it has enormous costs for the Russian economy, unemployment, poverty. So the fear of this also leading to unrest, to instability. And we're also seeing now that the Putin regime is gradually starting to lift this non-working state or condition. But it is, of course, as in other countries, a difficult balance. So it's a gradual lift and it can go back and forth. So whether Putin's political life is at stake, I think the question here we should also pose is, as in China, I guess, with Xi Jinping, who should take over? Because it seems that Putin has done a good job, as Xi Jinping has in China, in taking out potential rivals. And who would want to take over, right, just now in this crisis situation? It seems also that the Putin regime is actually been more open, transparent than we've seen in earlier crises. They are showing and they are admitting that the problems are huge and it's really difficult to handle, and it's unknown territory in many ways. So in that way, I think there is not that specifically related to the corona crisis. There is not so much opposition or criticism of the Putin regime as in other contexts or as in relation to other questions in relation to Russian economy and Russian politics. So my impression is that Putin is not weaker than before the crisis. And also Putin has been able to deal with a lot of crisis situations, right? So he seems to be very, not very easy to take out. So in that way, I think he's actually managing or coming through, not being weaker than before. But again, it might be too early to say. On the international scene, Russia has actually, again, as China, try to use the crisis to demonstrate, especially in its near neighborhood, that it is still, you know, an important influential power. It can still help out and assist its neighbors. We've actually even seen Russia delivering medical assistance and aid to some European countries, example, Italy. So that is also a way that Russia has tried to use the corona crisis to demonstrate that it's still an important power and it's still, you know, can do things on the international stage, positive things. So it's an effort to try to also push for a more positive image, but also push for this move away from what the Russians see as this US-led, US-dominated world order. And this has long been a central priority, you could say, in Russia and in Russian foreign security policy, that this push away from an international system led or dominated by the US. So I think the crisis here has also made it possible for Moscow to push that a bit further. But in the end, to stand as an influential power in the international system, to push for a more multipolar or a system with more great powers, you need hard power, right? You need a strong economy, you need a strong military. And this is, for Russia, as for China and the US, the core issue, right, is to get the economy back on track, to get the economy going again, so you can start on building up all your other capabilities. And here, The Putin regime also faces tremendous challenges. The Russian economy is rather dependent on export of energy and natural resources. So it relies also on the world prices getting back, and it doesn't look so good right now. So again, it's a huge challenge also here to actually get back on track, right?
All opinion polls show that China has never been more unpopular among US voters. How will the corona crisis affect US-China relations? Is President Trump forced to fulfill his threats of breaking ties with China? And is this really what he wants?
It's not only the Trump administration. There is a general growing criticism of China in the US, in both political parties and in the American, in the US population. So, and again, this started long before the corona crisis, which called for US-China decoupling, that the US was becoming too dependent on China. There was a call for pushing China or punishing China for treating, for cheating in trade, et cetera, the debt trap diplomacy related to the Belt and Road Initiative, et cetera. So there was a lot of criticism building up in the US towards China. And you could see kind of a general securitization of all China, all that is China in the US, where even Chinese activities within cultural exchange, Chinese students in the US, all were seen as potential security risks or security threats. So I think no matter whether Trump is reelected or not, US-China relations are in for a tough time. And I'm not sure what the Trump administration actually want, right? They want to, it seems they want to preserve the US dominance. They want to preserve, to maintain the US ability to direct what China and other countries do. They want to set the rules of the game. And then other countries should follow these rules, but this is not possible, and arguably it's never been. But it's clear that the US, of course, has had a kind of a dominant position in international economy, international politics, and military has been the strongest military power more or less since the end of the Cold War, and this is of course now changing, right? The U.S. is being challenged from a stronger, economic, militarily stronger China, a Russia that does different things on the international stage, more in specific geographical areas like the Arctic and Syria. And it's also challenged from inside the U.S., right, that there is no strong support to the U.S. Acting as this global policeman anymore. There is no strong support to going out fighting wars in the Middle East, etc. So it's also challenged from within the U.S. And it's really not clear how this will play out. And it seems that the Trump administration is determined to try to preserve this U.S. dominance, but that's already impossible, right? So how that will play out, I it's really difficult to see. The Trump administration clearly has put focus on what his administration has termed this great power competition, right? We saw that underlined in the most recent U.S. national security strategy from December 2017. That's kind of now this great power competition is now put up as the overall frame for U.S. foreign security and defense policy. But is it possible only to compete, only to have great power competition? You also need to cooperate, right? There's a lot of global challenges. There's a lot of international crisis that needs U.S.-China cooperation. So I think it's the Trump administration is kind of meeting reality somehow. Also with this current ongoing coronavirus, right? Is it possible to deal without it, without cooperating with China, with Russia? So So, and all this talk about US-China decoupling, is that at all possible? I think we might see what we could call like a partial or selective decoupling in certain areas like high tech and strategic infrastructure, etc. But is a total decoupling, is it that at all possible? Is there, you know, the economies are too intertwined. It would really hurt both US and China interests. So I think it's really difficult to see how it will further develop and what the Donald Trump and his administration really wants.
What would be the best outcome for China in the November elections, Donald Trump or Joe Biden?
Well, I think with Joe Biden, a kind of restart would at least be possible because he could start on a more clean slate. But again, the growing anti-China sentiment is widely shared across the two parties and in the population, right, in the US. But Joe Biden, also judging from his role as vice president under Obama, he seems to acknowledge that there is a need for also seeking cooperation with China on certain issue of common concern. And generally, he seems to acknowledge the need for dialogue, right? So I think at least we could there must be this possibility for a restart, which seems very difficult with the second term to Donald Trump.
It appears that China's popularity has also dropped dramatically in Brussels and among European voters because of the corona crisis. Does Europe have the prerequisite for reducing its economic dependence of China? Isn't the fact that large and medium-sized European companies are far too dependent on China?
Yes, again, this was a development already visible before the coronavirus, right? The most recent EU-China strategy from March last year termed China a systemic rival for the first time. It demonstrated, call it a more realistic, a more comprehensive analysis in the EU of the challenges and the opportunities that a stronger China would present in both international economy, politics, and military. So that it would challenge, like a stronger China would be a challenge for the values and the principles that the EU is built on. But in contrast to the US or the current Trump administration's more one-sided confrontational line, the EU's China approach or China strategy also stress that China is a partner in dealing with many of the global challenges. It's a competitor in economic terms, but it's not only negative to have a competitor, right? That it could also press the EU to what the European countries, the European companies to do better, to be more innovative, etc., etc. So there is, in general, I would say, a more comprehensive assessment. It's not all black and white when it comes to the EU's approach or strategy towards China. And it reflects, I think, an acknowledgement in Brussels that the EU has to deal with or needs to deal with a stronger China. Like, there's no challenge. There's no choice. Containment, decoupling, and all-out confrontation is not possible. And even if it was possible, it would not be in the interest of the EU or the individual European countries. And here it's also, you know, a big challenge for the EU to actually stand together, to unite all the EU member states in relation to their China approach or their China strategy. So I think all these challenges and these new trends we already saw before the corona crisis. And I think the line now from Brussels is more or less the same. There is this mix of cooperation, of dialogue, or trying to seek cooperation and seek dialogue, but also being very clear on where China is where the Chinese policies are challenging the values and the principles of the EU and the EU interests. So it's this mix of cooperation and competition, of dialogue and confrontation. And it's possible, as you also indicate, that the balance will shift further towards a more confrontational line also in Europe. There is definitely some anger and frustration of the most recent Chinese line of trying to to be more to censor US policy documents, to try to put pressure on the EU to support a more that kind of the Chinese narrative, as we talked about earlier. So there is definitely a possibility that the balance between, you know, cooperation, confrontation, or competition might shift more towards the confrontational line. But again, then reality kicks in, right? Because they need to work with China, as you also indicate, in a lot of areas, also economic areas, but also to deal with a lot of the global challenges, climate, etc. And what also plays in here is that the current very confrontational, not only on China, but generally confrontational, unilateral line from the Trump administration also causes frustration and anger in Brussels, right? So it's both to deal with a stronger China, a more assertive China, but also a more unilateral US that is really presenting the EU with huge challenges, finding its own way to navigate in that.
European solidarity has been absent during the corona crisis, at least according to Rome and Madrid. Is China playing an indirect role in the economic relief negotiations between Brussels on the one side and Italy and Spain on the other side?
I think the Chinese assistance to Italy and other EU member states have definitely displayed the inability or the unwillingness of EU member states to assist and help each other. So in that way, it's displayed what you could say the weaknesses or the lack of solidarity, especially with the hard hit countries in the southern part of Europe. And you could argue that the visible Chinese assistant that, for example, made the Italian five-star movement declare that China is, you know, Italy's real friend, not the EU, that this has forced the EU, it has forced Brussels to step up and do more. And now it's also put forward its own economic plan. So in that way, it's kind of been a push. But maybe it came late, right? And maybe it came too late. Because there is a lot of disappointment at the EU towards Brussels in Italy, in countries such as Italy now, and it's growing. I just read a statistic that showed that 49% of the Italians now want to leave the EU. So that's a rise of 20 percentage points since November 2018. So it's definitely causing a lot of frustration and anger in some of these countries that has been especially hard hit by the corona crisis. And that's also a challenge for the EU to deal with.
I have two more questions. Since the coronavirus crisis started, the relationship between the White House and the European Union appears to have deteriorated. Would it be possible for the relationship to survive if President Trump wins a second term in November?
Well, another difficult question. But again, there is, as I mentioned earlier, there is growing frustration and mistrust towards the Trump administration in several European capitals and in Brussels or in the EU, and it's related towards this US unilateralism. The Trump administration does not support multilateral cooperation, doesn't support international agreements, international rules, international commitments. So these are all elements that the EU values or is built on, right? So in that way, the current Trump administration is challenging the very fundament of the EU, and that's causing a lot of frustration and concerns both in Brussels and in the different European capitals. So how to deal with it? What can the EU do? Is a really difficult challenge. Ideally, as I also mentioned just before, ideally, the EU could work on taking a more autonomous stand, like a strategic assessment of where are actually the EU interests, the European interests, and how to navigate in this US-China great power rivalry. So find its own way to maneuver there. But it's not easy. And as we also talked about earlier, the EU or the European countries, they also share a lot of the US concerns about China. Especially related to unfair trade, etc. So they and human rights. So they share a lot of the U.S. concerns and criticism, but they don't share this confrontational approach, this kind of containment and the very black white approach. But again, it's also difficult to see a common EU stand on this, because some European countries are more positive or are seeking a closer cooperation with China than others, and other countries like Poland are seeking closer cooperation with the US. So there's also a challenge in simply getting the EU to stand together on this, and there is all this calls for kind of a rethinking in the EU on how to manage this. It's a very delicate or difficult balancing act. I think what we're seeing is that some European countries try to go further together. So not the whole EU, but some of the bigger European countries, such as France, the UK, Germany, they try to do things that prevent them from being caught in this US confrontation with China. So we see it both in relation to trade, in relation to even security, right? That we see France and UK, even Germany, having their navies in the Indo-Pacific and in Asia, doing their own what they call naval diplomacy, not to be caught up with the confrontation there between the US Navy and the Chinese Navy. So they try to find their own way, being not as confrontational as the U.S. Navy, like sailing close to Chinese the Chinese coast, etc. So, trying to find a way to still show that there are, you know, that they are not supportive of the Chinese position, that they are having a lot of concerns about the Chinese conduct or the Chinese behavior, but not doing it in this very all-out confrontational way. But it's a huge challenge to find this balance. I agree.
It is, of course, too early to make firm conclusions from the corona crisis, as the crisis might not be over. A second wave might emerge in the autumn. It seems, however, that the world faces a tough economic time. Will this lead the world into a significantly less peaceful place?
Well, again, the corona crisis has accelerated developments in international economy, politics, and security that were already underway. So most significantly, the U.S.-China confrontation, or this growing tension between the U.S. and China. And this is the most dangerous thing, I think, because none of them, neither China or the U.S., is willing to back down. And it is really a dangerous development, especially, as I indicated just in the previous answer, especially in East Asia, because in East Asia is where you have China most directly challenging the U.S. Position, right? The U.S. has been the dominant power, the dominant economic power, the dominant military power, and also the ones who kind of set the rules of the game in East Asia since more or less since the end of the Second World War. And China is now challenging that and is able to challenge that. The Chinese Navy is able to challenge the U.S. Navy. The Chinese are presenting the regional states in East Asia with economic aid and packages and things that are actually, you know, challenging the U.S. as the one setting the rules of the game, the whole Belt and Road initiative, the way it's playing out. So I think tension in East Asia, and that's the most dangerous, I think, region here, because that's where you could actually have a direct military confrontation between the U.S. and China. And we're seeing, as we already talked about, we're seeing tension there growing in the Taiwan Strait. We are also seeing it growing in the South China Sea and in several places in China's periphery, Hong Kong, China, India, the China, Philippines. There are a lot of tensions building up. And in almost all of these situations or crisis, you have China and the US on each side, right? So that's a really dangerous development in East Asia, I think. That's the main battleground, you could say, for the US-China great power rivalry. But in other regions, in Europe, in the Middle East, Africa, it will play out also this US-China rivalry, but more in economics terms, in the technology, like where there will be this competition to be the ones that are kind of setting the rules of the game, that's coming in with their designs, with their solutions, and kind of coming to dominate the market. So I think we'll see this rivalry play out, and that makes the world, you could say, a more unstable, unpredictable, and more dangerous place all in all. So, but again, this was already on its way before the coronavirus. So the coronavirus has in many ways accelerated, highlighted it, but it was already on the way. And it's simply because China in hard power, as we would call it in international politics, the hard power in economic and military, they're beginning to be able to challenge the US dominant position. And that is what then is playing out differently in different regions.
Thank you, Camilla Nørup Sørensen, for taking part in this podcast.
You're welcome.